This week on Intrigued Full Effect.
So we know trauma can rewire the brain, but the right treatment and the right support and the right relationship, we can rewire the brain for healing as well. And I think that we don't really talk about that enough.
I'm Chandrea Thomas, and welcome to episode 55. In this podcast, I talk about curious cases, disappearances, and other stuff. And today we're having a deep conversation that covers a lot. We're talking about trauma. So that's why I invited Dr. Damond Holt, who is a trauma expert and a pastor, along with Theda Wilson, who is a trauma survivor and an advocate for families with missing loved ones. Now, this is a conversation that might help you in more ways than you realize. We talked about ambiguous loss, grief, and a lot of other issues affecting our community. This is what happened. I am here with trauma expert Dr. Damond Holt and Theda Wilson, who is someone I've known from my time working in St. Louis as a journalist. Today, we're doing something different. We're talking about trauma and the impact of trauma of people, you know, who live in violent cities, who've experienced trauma, who's been victims of crime, and all of those things, missing and murdered people in their families, all of that. We want to get into some really deep conversations about the impact of all of that. And I think the two of you are the perfect people to have this really good conversation with. So thank you both for being here. I appreciate that.
We have them.
Absolutely. Now, Dr. Holt, let me ask you this really quickly, just to get it clarified. How do you define trauma?
That's a really good question. Seeing that trauma is like the buzzword, everybody talking about trauma, PTSD, things of that nature. But a lot of times people don't even know what that is. And so from a doctor's perspective, according to the American Psychological Association, they define trauma to be a wound or an emotional injury to the brain that is physical, emotional, or sexual. As a traumatologist and trauma doctor, I like to put an extra little sauce on it to make it more lay people's language, is that pretty much it's a wound or injury when life devastating and life threatening things has happened to you. So it doesn't just impact the brain. Sometimes trauma actually rewires the brain. So people are not exactly the same prior to that incident that happened. So that's how we look at it. It's an injury and wound to the brain when traumatic experiences has happened to that person.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is it about trauma that made you go into that specialty? I'm just curious.
I hear a lot of people ask that. I felt like I was called to it. I don't think I chose it. I think I gravitated towards it because I thought that number one, the way we're trained in alternative medicine is to look, and functional medicine is to investigate root causes to disease. And so I began to look at trauma as being many of the root causes to many of our chronic diseases in our body, and also mood disorders and psychiatric disorders in the brain. You know, you weren't born depressed, so something happened to your life to bring depression. And there is a huge alignment of traumatic experience, especially early childhood traumas, that while we have so many adults today that are struggling with mental illness like depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, and even substance abuse as well. You know, that opens the door. Trauma opens the door for substance abuse too. So people are using drugs and alcohol to cope with their pain and trauma that they never dealt with. So now you got two issues. You still got the same original issue of trauma you never identified, and now you have an addiction problem. So although that is one of the big reasons why I went into the area, to really look at root causes by which many people are not well mentally, emotionally, and physically.
Yeah, and I've always wondered too, like if trauma is something, you know, when I think about slavery and all of that stuff, if it's like in your DNA almost, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, most definitely. As a traumatologist, I have trainings and research on all kind of things in regards to trauma. So I teach on acute trauma, chronic trauma, complex trauma, generational trauma, historical trauma, relational trauma, vicarious trauma. There's all kind of ways you can go at it. But most definitely, And in my research and in some of the trainings I do for different agencies, most definitely, there's something called race-based trauma. We call it racial trauma. Me and a colleague right now is writing a book called Black Trauma. And so I actually speak about the science of epigenetics, which is many of our experiences do impact the way our genes are expressed in our DNA. And so when that happens, we pass those along. So a lot of times what great-great-grandmama endured, she passed it on to grandmama. And because in our community, especially Black communities, we don't go to doctors, we don't like seeing therapists, we pass it on to the mother, and then the mother passes it on to the daughter, daughter passes it down to the grandchild. So this is the reason why sometimes we are in that vicious cycle in certain communities in regards to our traumas, because, you know, we don't identify it. And then sometimes just a lack of knowledge. We just didn't understand that when my great granddaddy went through, no wonder, you know, his son got anger issues and he got domestic violent cases. So it can really go deep, but most definitely it impacts the way our genes are expressed, which is trauma also doesn't impact the brain, but trauma also impacts the body. And this is the reason why we see more metabolic diseases and chronic diseases and autoimmune disease and individuals as well, because of a lot of trauma stress that our brain doesn't turn off. So we see it in our GI. We see more people with a lot of trauma stress, have a lot of stomach issues, immunity issues, can't really rebound from disease because of all of that stress. And then my concern is if we don't turn the trauma off and it's impacting the body, then we have something called chronic and cellular inflammation, which is a whole nother conversation, which creates more medical conditions and disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, Theda, I know you've been through your sense of, trauma, and not only with that, but you also help other people going through their own trauma. So you're not only are you managing your own situation, but you're also absorbing other people's stuff too. So how are you managing that, and how has your trauma kind of manifested itself in your life since your son disappeared?
Well, I guess I'll start just by thanking Dr. Hope for even mentioning all the things and reminding me of the miracle that I am, because as a child growing up in the hood, of course, I've experienced a lot of trauma, things that occurred that, some people around me, even within my family, they may never speak of, but I remember. And that's one reason why I'm trying to therapeutically just write about those things, put those into a book to hopefully encourage other people so that they will be inspired to live in spite of their circumstances. So me having a missing child and then serving other people with missing loved ones, knowing that they may be found deceased, a lot of times missing person cases or just murder cases waiting to be solved. So it's like I had to already prepare myself, which I feel like life just growing up in the hood just prepared me, because there were a lot of things that I had to learn how to do to adjust, code switching. I look like a little boy growing up. So sometimes I put that little swag walk on just to avoid certain circumstances, because I was afraid that if they knew I was a female, that I may be raped or something like that. So just growing up in those kind of environments, and then eventually being a product of the St. Louis public school system, learning, what I needed to in order to educate the people that I served, because I worked as a teacher. So I was able to identify things that I remembered I went through. I was able to see it in my children. I was able to say, baby, did you eat today? People didn't ask me if I ate, but I knew, and I had learned that if I didn't eat, I may have hypoglycemic episodes or feel like my blood sugar is low. And then I knew that in my readings that a lot of people who committed certain kind of crimes, their blood sugar levels were low. And so I'm just thinking about all the things that I could do within my life, just by eating right, sleeping right, thinking right, just being right, putting myself in the right environments, just trying to manage everything that I could do. I found myself doing those things and trying to teach people how to do the same thing through my efforts of saving people by increasing awareness and, helping families navigate the missing person process through looking for an angel.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering too, how have you been able to, because your situation went on for years and years and years, and you still don't have the full answers as to where your son is to this day. So I just wonder, how do you manage that? How do you mentally deal with it? And do you go to therapy for that? How are you dealing with that?
Well, I remember when therapy was offered to me, and a lot of times I was like, you know, just being a victim of crime and the type of crime that was committed, you know, first of all, there are some agencies that won't even really address or provide services like I think it's crime victims compensation. I know that when I'm trying to help some families here in Missouri, the governor has this I think he's the one that created the law or has something to do with the law being created. But if you're a victim of crime, there are services that are available to you that are not available to those with missing loved ones. And being a missing person or having a missing person in your family, you are impacted by crime. So I'm like, why are those services available if your son is deceased or your child, your loved one is found deceased? But in this ambiguous state that we find ourselves in, why isn't there like some psychological services or counseling service, behavioral services available to people like us? You know, I happen to get them because I knew how to get those, but a lot of times police officers or different agencies, they're not aware of these services being out there. And I think that they just look at missing person situations differently because of the fact that we're dealing with ambiguous grief, or we can't put our finger exactly on it because we don't have a body to bury. We don't know where they are. We don't know if they're dead. We don't know if they're alive. But still, I feel like counseling is a big part. It's something that needs to be done. And of course, a lot of Black people don't like doing it. I mean, I personally didn't even want to do it going through the trial process or trying to get justice for my son, because my situation started as a domestic situation. So we were in civil courts. The father was basically trying to strip me of my children wrongfully. I was never proven unsuitable, unfit, or unable, because I am suitable, I'm fit, and I'm able. But yet and still, there was a system that was on his side, even though he's in jail for life now, and even though he killed my son. But, you know, before all of that had transpired, they gave my child over to him knowing that it was not what was in the best interest of my children. I even had to deal with the grief with that. You know, nobody was interested in, they claimed to be interested in reunifying my family, but they did nothing to reunify my family because they told me there's nothing for me to do because they knew I hadn't done anything. Mm-hmm. So that led to other issues. And just think, to me, it's just like a miracle that I didn't become what I hate, you know, or that I didn't commit a crime or do something horrible. If it wasn't for the fact that I believed in, that I believe in God, I would be a mess, because I'm a great thinker. And I could think of things that nobody would want me to even think of. They probably wouldn't even think that I thought those kind of things. But in dealing with the things that I deal with, I have to think like the criminals. I have to think of where things could be, where my baby's body could be. I don't want to think about these things. But in order to solve the crime, sometimes you have to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm willing to allow my brain to go places, but at the same time, I can't allow my brain to stay in those places, because then I'll become what I hate. Mm-hmm. So it's just really, you know, it's a miracle, because I know that I'm doing some things that cops won't even do. And some cops need psychological service. They have psychological services available for them, but they don't even have them all for those with missing loved ones. And then there's a stigma attached with getting those services, which is really what I was trying to get to, because when they stripped me of my children, they made me take, I guess, a DSM-5. Or whatever, yeah. Because the judge thought that there was something wrong with me psychologically.
Psychological assessment.
Exactly. But the thing was, the lady wound up saying, well, she could be an engineer. She's extremely intelligent, but we think she's faking good. So, you know, but I already know that there was a lot of biases in my situation because of the political influence that the father's people had and things like that. So I was able to, I had to prepare my mind for a straight up battle, mm-hmm. because the system was not willing to say what it is. So but because God had already prepared me, I was able to duck and move and jab and do what I had to do, mm-hmm. emotionally, and physically to navigate this process. But a lot of people are not able to do that. And then we're producing more problems in the community because now we have people who are victims of crime, who have missing loved ones, who have murdered loved ones if they get a resolution, and then they're ready to take those issues into their own hands and become those victims that we find behind bars because the system has failed them. And so it's like we know what to do, but we're not allowing families to get the services that they need, or either we're labeling them because they got the services that they needed, and then we're using that as a reason to keep them from having their children.
Wow. So, you know? And actually, let me go to Dr. Holt about that, because, you know, culturally speaking, how she was saying, like, there's a stigma and all of that. How much difficulty have you seen in your time as far as getting people of color to come in, you know, to get those types of services? Has it been a challenge that you've seen over time?
Oh, most definitely, especially in the communities of color. It's a big challenge, especially African-Americans in particular. Which culturally, you know, sometimes when it comes to mental health and wellness, we come with early childhood traumas. We come, as Theda said, you know, come from the hood. I came from the hood. I'm not just a trauma expert. I'm a trauma survivor, being born and raised out of Flint, Michigan, on the hood on the north side. Wow. So most of all my friends are dead or in prison, and my trajectory was the same. You know, if I didn't have a church, if I didn't have the Urban League giving me my first job, so I wouldn't have to sell dope. If I had educators that wouldn't let me drop out of school and make sure I went to college and became very successful. So those things are very, very important. And another thing, too, is a lot of our childhood traumas come with secrets in the family. A lot of times things happen to us. We're not allowed to talk about it. We are not allowed to expose the perpetrator. And sometimes stranger danger is not the one we should be watching. It should be those caregivers and those family members who are inappropriate touching, molesting, and all of those different things in the Black family. And so we create these barriers, these walls, to try to, we think, protect, but we're really imprisoning people. And so when they get older, we wonder how do so many adults have so many mental illness and psychiatric disorders and mood disorders. It's because a lot of that stuff that happened that messed with our brains, that injured our brains, we never properly identified it. We never properly treated it. And then another thing, too, is we bring victims around perpetrators because we don't allow them to point the finger at who did it and all of that. All of that plays a major part in the African-American thing. Two, I would talk about is it's not enough of us, which means that there's not enough doctors of color, especially even on the psychological side. We only represent 4% in the nation. So that means most African-Americans and people of color who goes to see a doctor is going to get someone who lives in a different zip code, don't know nothing about the hood, don't know nothing about hypervigilance of hearing bullets passing by you, gunshots, seeing a homie get blasted, all of that, or gang violence. They're far removed. And this is also an education issue, too, because that's some of our teachers that come into these spaces trying to teach Black and brown kids, and they have no idea of what a kid is going through. A kid is not paying attention to algebra when they stumbling is growling. You know, so we have to really understand what this really means. And this also a plug, because my book is out on that, called Trauma is the New Public Health Emergency in Education. So we have a lot of educators using my book as a book study throughout the nation, looking at all of the different traumas of how it has drastically impacted the educational system. So, yeah, so going back to that is very, very important that we have a space where people can go and see their doctor and remove the stigma. You don't feel some kind of way to have a dentist work on your teeth. You don't have a cardiologist. You don't feel some kind of way for a cardiologist to work on your heart. So why do we have such a stigma for doctors to work on our minds? So we got to do better and get the word out. Mental health doesn't mean psychotic. Mental health doesn't always mean straight jackets and all of the extreme therapies that takes place, mental health is the same as type 2 diabetes. It's just, this is our mind, it's our brain. And if we don't feel some kind of way to take metformin to reduce our glucose levels with diabetes, then we should not feel some kind of way to see our psych docs and our psychologists and counselors as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the other part of it too. Like you both were saying, there's this whole stigma. Culturally, there's a stigma. Pray it away, go to church, talk to your pastor, all that. And that could be part of it, absolutely. Yeah. But it's not the full picture of what people need to get done, right?
Oh my God, yes. Yeah. I'm sorry, Tika.
Okay, I'll try to give the floor back to you. But I was just thinking about that, because a lot of times, especially when you're talking about trauma that happens in families, I can understand the parent, you know, just wondering, what do I do if I expose the fact that my guy or my husband is doing something inappropriate my child or a child that I know? You know, I know that that's hard to deal with, but and that's his close to home too, because of what the perpetrator did to his own children or the children that were in his care, you know. So it's like, these kids are messed up for life. They don't know what family means anymore, because they were in a place that they thought was a family, and then they found out that they were violated, or what, or their idea. They didn't even have an idea until they went through what they went through. And some of those people think that's normal. Like it's some kind of rite of passage that it's okay for an adult to touch you at a certain age. You know, I remember back in the day when my kids were little, were, I was listening to, I know I listened to a Christian radio station, but some other one was talking about those types of touch meaning something positive, like it was supposed to happen. No, it's the fact is that it's happening, and people aren't dealing with the fact that it's happening. You know, I knew some things when I was young that my parents didn't know until I was older and told them what I knew.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I was a great educator, because I was like, hey, no, you cannot go in the basement. No, because I remembered what happened in the basement, or I remembered what happened to my friends at their in their situations. You know, I remember the pains of life, and I take everything that God has allowed me to endure and live through. I bring that stuff with me, so that when I'm counseling these families, while I'm providing these services, I'm able to understand exactly where they're coming from, instead of looking at them like, oh my God, you let this happen or that happened to you. I'm not surprised by anything that happens in life, because I've already lived through things that I thought they would kill me.
And that's
so,
the thing,
you
too.
Know, and then there's some counselors. I also want to know what the doctor had to say about people when they're trying to get counseling. Like in my situation, I had some people tell me they wouldn't counsel my surviving child because my case was high profile. So my child, okay, they're in law school now, and we could be doing better, but the traumas of life have impacted us in the way that they have. But even though that we look good on paper, still just thinking about the fact that my baby could do better, maybe if they had a better chance, if those counselors would have stepped in instead of saying, oh, your case is high profile, and we think we may be brought into court. And if we come into court, then courts don't typically pay us. So now you just on your own. What do you have to say about that?
I have a lot to say about that. I think number one, anytime whether it fits on the psychological side or the medicine side, high quality of care is absolutely necessary. And we should never lower the standards of that. And I think that when it may be challenging because of a political arena or some media arena, that we drop the ball and we lack the support, then we're being negligent as clinicians and practitioners. We don't care about that stuff. I don't give a doggone, you Republican, you Democrat, or you a Biden supporter or a Trump supporter. That's not going to stop me from being the doctor. We take an oath to make sure that we are giving the highest level of quality of care. So I'm sorry that happened. Secondly, you're exactly right. The outcomes most definitely can be better when we can catch young people earlier as possible. Frederick Douglass said, it's far easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. And so I really hold that as a core value. The quicker that we can catch young people during brain development and all of that, the better we can start also rewiring. So we re-rewire the brain. So we know trauma can rewire the brain, but the right treatment and the right support and the right relationship, we can rewire the brain for healing as well. And I think that we don't really talk about that enough. And Sandrea, you made a great point that I didn't get to elaborate is, you know, when it comes to faith and it comes to the church realm, sometimes we just think, you know, oh, we're just going to preach it away, shout it away, and pray it away. And we still got to deal with the science, and God gave us the science, and everything is not a demon. Some things can be, and everything is not. Some things is just disorders and dysfunctions that's going on in the brain and in the body that we have to address. Now, my thing, I like the holistic approach to where you need to see your doctor for the body, see your therapist for the mind, and see your pastor for the soul, because the way that our bodies are created is mind, body, and soul. So if you have support and getting services from the spiritual side, from the mental side, from the physical side, it increases your outcome. So like me, I like to partner with other, so because sometimes pastors do counseling, right? So I like to partner with the pastor. I like to partner with the therapist, because I can do things that they can't do. I can look at labs, right? I can look at your cortisol levels just through your labs alone and be like, oh yeah, that trauma is real by just looking at how your panels read. So yeah, it's a holistic approach, and by which I think that we should look at how do we push the narrative on wellness. Mm-hmm. And I've actually had pastors invite me to come in and speak on their Sunday services and made a Sunday, mental health Sunday service where it really blessed the whole congregation. And I always have many people come to me like, oh my God, like you hit so many points. So I just think that we have to do better on promoting wellness and also saying it's okay not to be okay. We don't have to fake the funk. We don't have to fake it till we make it. There are just some times, it's just some bad days. Yes, we're going to have some victorious days, but just on events based on our triggers, what triggers, certainly we can have emotional downward spirals. And Tuesday is just not a good day, you know, and it's okay to let Tuesday not be a good day. Mm-hmm. Set boundaries, set some, do some self-care, doing the things that you need to do so that you can promote your own healing.
Yeah. You know, here's another thing I was, you know, when I was living in St. Louis, I was like, man, you know, we covered so many devastating crimes, and it's so, you know, the kids are immersed in seeing crime every single day. And I always wonder, when you're in such an environment like that, and some people feel like they just can't escape it and the cycle continues. And I know Theda can probably speak to that as well, but I'm wondering, like, what can we do? You know, when you do see things, I know we've tried, you know, like Theda says, she talks to kids, she understands, you know, when she sees and sees the signs and things like that. But I'm wondering, just in general, what can people just do in general? Is there a way for people to help who may not be all the way in it, but they see it? You know what I'm saying? Like, what can you do?
Yeah. So there's some most, you know, Bruce Perry, a big psychiatrist that in the field of trauma, like I am, says that the greatest therapy is human love. And I think it all starts out with love. Believe it or not, love creates safety. When a person feels real genuine love, it shifts the brain from being hyper aroused in that fight or flight, on guard, ready to snap, ready to post up, ready to put hands on people, right? That's that fight or flight, that freeze response, right? And I think a lot of times we don't talk about that trauma response is not a one-hit wonder. What happens when your brain is stuck on high alert? What happens if you're always living in a hood, you know, you're living in poverty, or, you know, you're constantly seeing violence? Well, our brain gets stuck. That's also with kids, too. So when kids come to school, there's what I say in my work is a hijacking of the frontal lobe in the prefrontal cortex. So it doesn't matter how great the teacher is teaching mathematics and teaching algebra, if I'm in flight or flight and I'm wondering where I'm going to stay and lay my head when the last bell ring, I'm not paying attention to pedagogy. I'm not paying attention to curriculum. So I think that we need to be understanding what trauma does to us and how it keeps us stuck. And then I haven't even went into other avenues where, you know, I got a slide on one of my trainings where it talks about trauma impacts the cognition, the physical, the emotional, the mental, and all of these different things. And that's important because if I'm going through trauma, I also have attachment issues, right? Because the dissociation is so real and every system has failed me. I don't trust as easy, right? So that just don't happen. That just don't happen when I'm 9 and 13. That happens when I'm 31 and 42 and 55. So I come into these spaces trying to build relationships, build friendships, or even marriage, you know, and I had all this stuff I never dealt with when I was 9 years old. Now this other person is paying for a debt that somebody else wrote the check. I always call it, if we don't heal from our traumas, we're going to bleed on people that didn't cut us. And so we see all that bleeding and hemorrhaging on all kind of people because we're never given a chance to just focus on our own cuts and wounds from the traumas that has happened to us.
That's a really good one.
I'm sorry. One thing that I did when I worked for the public school system here in St. Louis was I was able, as a family and community specialist, I was able to bring in different organizations or different agencies, counseling agencies. I know like the WOW program or BHR, pass out literature, just to make the families aware of the services that are out there. A lot of services that are free, you know, so just, you know, there were some great things happening in the St. Louis public school system, even though, and I feel like we were doing the big work because we didn't have all the monies that a lot of these private institutions had, but we, you know, were at least, I definitely was tapping into those resources because I wanted to provide what was best for my families. And then when you have a great PTO at your school, you know, usually if you find a school with a great PTO, you're going to have a school with better grades and better pretty much everything because those parents are involved in their child's care. But unfortunately, because we were a public school and we were free, a lot of people weren't able to tap into a lot of those services because they had to hold two or three jobs, which was causing more trauma, you know, and just being able to look at things differently as an educator. So, you know, like I didn't think that just because a parent didn't show up at school to pick up a report card that they didn't want to be there. No, I know my parents and I know they have more than one job, you know, but still that parent has to deal with the fact that they can't be there when they want to be there. So I think that's another reason why it is good for us to seek out help, not just from our friends and family, but sometimes from some professionals. But unfortunately, all the people that are professional aren't professional. You know, I appreciate everything that Mr. Holt is speaking about. And I wish we had a plethora of you. But the truth is that at least here in St. Louis.
Yeah, I would just,
I mean, you'd be glad if you could come over here.
I was just out there. I was the keynote on for trauma resilience at Riverview Garden Schools.
That was a great place
to
be.
They had me come out in, I believe it was in August. I did a big keynote on trauma resilience because I talk about trauma informed is not enough. We're just talking about the same problems. We got to create building blocks to shift from trauma informed to trauma resilience. And I think that that's what we miss too, that there's power and resilience that we don't talk enough. It doesn't mean that the trauma did not hurt us and the trauma still doesn't impact us, but we're not allowing it to rob us of our future and to keep us down. And so that's why I talk about that resiliency, because we don't get to that trauma resilience. So I created a training model for schools, for foster care agencies, called the TRS, Trauma Resilient Schools, where I start teaching about how do we move from just talking about what has happened and what's been done to actually creating that healing journey. And it's certainly a journey and it looks different for everybody. It's case by case, you know, and the time frame, the duration of what that looks like. But I think in these spaces, we do have to talk more about the power of resilience that is in all of us and how we can rebound and how we can be still be successful and still impact others who have had their traumas as well. It's a village, and we come together as a village to create a space of healing. And I think we need to talk more on that resilience and healing piece, because most definitely being a person of faith, I do know there's healing in God. I do believe that, we're like the Timex watch. We can take some lickets and keep on ticking. We can keep moving forward, right?
So I'm telling your age. Our ages.
Yeah.
Okay, so Dr. Holt, you were talking about, you know, the whole issue of healing in the community and all of that. So how do you feel that people can really embrace that and help get things going to make things better for their communities?
I think that we have to wrap our heads around healing is dope. We are our best versions when we are healed. And we're starting a healing version. A man that is working on his early childhood trauma is less angry and explosive, and can use his words to communicate better. He's more regulated when he's starting his healing journey. A sister that recognizes her trauma, what has happened. She don't have to bleed all over the place with her emotions. She can use her words to say exactly how she's feeling and articulate what that looks like, and also have self-value about herself. And not walk around with low self-esteem and less value because looking at yourself as damaged goods, all of the negative stuff that we articulate. It can go from all kind of different spaces when it comes to that healing journey. Churches got to realize that you don't know everything and you don't have all of the answers, and you can learn too. And we can start looking at, even in churches, how do we even do, I don't expect them to do clinician practitioner type of work, but you know, what does tier one mental health support services look like in youth ministries and young adult ministries at church, where a lot of people that just come into church have all of these early childhood traumas? Having brave conversations. It may be tough. It may be rough to have these discussions, but you can't conquer something that you're not willing to confront. So you first got to be able to confront it and talk about the bad and the ugly way before you can get to the good part. We got to remove the stigma. We got to quit making people feel some kind of way because they are getting help. Sometimes it's not just verbals. I don't think people understand. You express nonverbals when people say they see a doctor. They just stare at you like you're crazy.
You get that.
But they actually just look at you like, what? So,
or you know, yeah. That stuff too. That part right there. Like,
So it all looks different, and getting help may be one-on-one, getting help may be group therapy, getting help maybe even family therapy. So I think that let's not be one-dimensional. Sometimes the whole family got to come together and talk about issues. And then sometimes it's couples, sometimes it's groups, sometimes it's individual. But we just all got to come to a place where it's okay to not be okay. You identify what those needs are, and then you let me say this: getting a doctor is not equivalent to all people. What I mean is that you need to be a little bit, you need to vet your doctor. You need to make sure that your doctor, your traumas, your therapist is trauma informed. They understand, because there's a lot of clinicians that are still not trauma informed. They just want you to sit in a chair, talk about your depression, and then invoice your insurance. That is not what you're looking for, right? You need somebody who's relevant to you. It may be you're a female, you've been through a lot. You don't, even though he's a male doctor, you don't feel comfortable talking to a male therapist. You probably want a female that connects with you more, vice versa. It could be male. It's the same way I know some females. I mean, my wife is the same. I will, but not see a male OBGYN. She's like, it ain't happening. Because of her experiences. And I get it. Like, because you got to feel safe. You got to feel like people understand you. They get you. You got to feel like you're seen and affirmed. So when we're talking about this place of getting healing, I'm just trying to throw out as many things in the time we had. that is very, very necessary. You know, you might not need a therapist that's from the Hamptons and from Hollywood and from Beverly Hills and just got theory and got did their dissertation on research, but have no lived experience. And here you are in the hood, been through hell and high water, and they're totally disconnected, right? So those are the things I think we don't talk enough about. Is we say, yeah, go get help, but it's not just as simple. You got to get the right help. You need to have the right therapist. And sometimes it may be, I need a therapist of color. I need somebody that understood, you know, what it's like, you know, living in these spaces and things of that nature. So when we say get help and bring healing, I just want to just articulate and throw a lot of extra sauce on that, that I think a lot of times we don't articulate enough. And so this is where people say, well, I went to the therapy, that don't work. No, it doesn't mean the therapy didn't work. You might didn't have the right practitioner. You might not have the right clinician that really, one, specialize in your issue, have some enough lived experience to be able to connect with you. So those are some extra things we need to know. Because I think you also added, why do people say, well, I ain't getting there because it don't work. Sometimes people actually try, but it wasn't the right practitioner and clinician. So we really need to have this harmonious relationship between patient and practitioner as well.
And I think people need to also understand that when they have their own trauma, and that, like I said, I'm not a parent yet, but I've seen it where what happens to them trickles down. And I don't think people really realize how much of an impact their trauma, their energy has on their generation, you know, their kids and their circle. Really, their circle, because sometimes people, when they have their trauma, they kind of drain, you know, drain on you too, because they're not dealing with it, but you're absorbing all of that from them. And it's just really hard to, you know what I mean, to manage that too.
Yeah, most definitely. I think that that's what goes into my other book, Hurting People Hurt People, Stop Bleeding on People That Didn't Cut You. So that's another book. You guys, a great resource.
Is that on Audible?
It's not yet. I'm talking to people to get that on Audible. Right now it is hard copy and ebook right now. But yeah, and yeah, I mean, you got to deal with your cuts and your wounds, because you're going to bleed on people that didn't cut you. Parents do it to kids. Husbands do it to wives. Wives do it to husbands. Teachers do it to their students. Police officers do it to their neighborhoods. If we do not deal with our cuts and wounds, we would just blah. We just spill on everybody, and it's not fair. And that impacts our closest relationships. That impacts our marriages. You know, I always said, you know, I know we do pre-counseling, but as a trauma doctor, I always said, man, we did a trauma assessment before people got married. Lord have mercy.
A lot of stuff.
I just up with the counselor part. You need a trauma assessment. You need to know what you walking in day one, your first 100 days, because people are battling with some real demons and disorders that you have no clue.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
then they'll be ready to sue you for bringing out the truth.
So Theta, let me ask you this question. You know, and I know that you've been able to kind of heal yourself, right? You know, your situation by helping other people. So how are you transitioning with that now? Are you still kind of moving forward and growing your organization and what you guys are doing for people in the public? Because I know you're kind of like a face of the community now with certain issues. So how is that going?
It's going. I'm thinking about trying to let certain things go and go more in a personal, moving into a, I mean, I do this because I'm a personal advocate, but I'm not getting as much support or the supports that I need through the organization. And actually the things that I've done through the organization, they've pretty much moved me to just want to just go all in on a personal level, because there are things that I like to do since I love the law and I love breaking down the law and I love debating and I love expressing myself. There's some things that I can't do under the umbrella or under as a nonprofit leader, because I have to be nonpartisan. There's some things that I can't do to get those 501c3 dollars that I can, that if I did it in my personal capacity, I can do. So it's sometimes people can't, I guess, you know, like some people will come to me and ask me to do certain things, and I'm saying I can't do that under looking for an angel. But I can do that on my personal time. And so I've been going back and forth, but actually I feel like I would have a stronger impact if I just kind of let the one side go, create legislation like I've been doing in my personal capacity to make the system do what it should be doing anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's like I'm up here trying to get all these dollars, get people to volunteer, get people to do all this stuff when we have a system that's already designed to, they say that they're doing this stuff, but my thing is you're not, so I'm gonna make you do it.
Okay.
So I feel like we all have the power within us to do it once we know how the system works. Mm-hmm. So it's just like if I could go straight to Jefferson City and get someone to create legislation to add a picture instead of a silhouette, yes, on a Miss a Person flyer. First of all, who even came up with the idea that it's okay to put a silhouette out here to represent a person that's missing when there's almost 1,400 people missing from the state of Missouri right now? Mm-hmm. So instead of going to Cardinal games, we should be maybe looking for these people that are missing. And how come we're not pulling together people from different municipalities? That's one of the complaints about St. Louis. We have so many municipalities. You roll from one into the other and you can get tickets all down the block. But my thing is, why aren't we just collaboratively just pulling people from those different municipalities and having those people go out to look for our people? Mm-hmm. Now, I can't do that through looking for an angel. I mean, I could probably say, okay, this is a great idea. But if I can get a legislator to make it real, mm-hmm, to put it on paper and to hold people accountable for not doing it, to me, that's where the power is. So, yeah, you know, the more I do this work, the more I just want to make it easier. Mm-hmm. I want to work smarter. And I want to hold these officials that we're putting in positions of power accountable, because they do what we want. They can do what we want them to do, but they're doing what they want to do. And a lot of them are too comfortable. Mm-hmm. And we're not calling them out and making them do the jobs that we put them there to do. So instead of us getting mad at each other, we ought to get mad at those people that we're putting in positions of power, you know, who are allowing these things to happen. And even the leadership in the church, I'm just saying, a lot of times they want to pray things away. How many pastors really weren't there for me? Mm-hmm. You know, or they wanted me to create a ministry in their church, which was our church. But now you're giving me, I'm already traumatized. Now I got to run the organization and do this for your church. Yeah. Really? Yeah. I can barely stay alive by myself. You're not even going out looking for my baby. Mm. Really?
And you know,
but what about before my child went missing and all I wanted was somebody to see my baby when Christian was in a coma? I had a pastor that refused to go and see my child in the hospital. Wow. And I never even said anything to them because I was like, well, you know, other people have first. I mean, my thing is, look, okay, if you're afraid to do it, send one of your pastoral friends. So my thing is, I understand we're all people. We all have our fears. We all can do so much. But at least explain to me why you're not doing the things that I expect you to do. And maybe my expectations are too high and this church is not for me. But I've been through a plethora of churches. And a lot of them have at least one of them showed me the door. A lot of them, this one, well, he was friends with his daddy. when a pastor looking at you directly and says the doors of the church are open, and you like, wait a minute, you talking to me? Yeah, they talking to you. I'm just saying, people know that I'm gonna say it like it is. That's one thing about me. I don't care what capacity I find myself in. I may say it gently, but I'm gonna say it if it needs to be said. And if they don't want me there, then it's time to move on. And that's how courageous my battle has made me now. It's like, at first I was like, oh, if I say this, the police gonna get mad and then they're not gonna look for my son. Well, they ain't gonna look anyway. They're not looking anyway. So what are we gonna do to make them look? And we can use the military force. They're not even using the military. Okay, we can send them to another country to fight a war, but we can't fight this missing person battle right here in America? Really?
St. Louis? And Theta, and actually, that's what's leading me to another question that I have, because when we're talking about missing persons cases, and I know you mentioned ambiguous loss earlier, because I think that's something that I really want to kind of get into a little bit. We have probably about 20 some 30 minutes left. I think we can talk. So when it comes to ambiguous loss, Dr. Holt, that seems like such a difficult thing to really grab a hold of, because there are so many unanswered questions. How do people, you know, really manage or deal with that? And that's something that Theda can maybe, you know, take some insight off of as well.
Yeah, so I think that she said some heartbreaking things. I mean, like, when you can't go to any institution for love and support, you know you should be able to go to the house of God.
Exactly.
To be a person of faith and have that spiritual institution let you down, that's traumatizing in itself, because that goes against your moral compass in regards to supporting people who really need that support. And it sounds like certain pastors was like, I need your issue to benefit my church. And if you can't do that, then I don't see no point why I would go see your child. I mean, it doesn't benefit. And that's heartbreaking. That's a moral composition, because it's against the principles of Christ, right? So this is like with people in the hospital, he said, go visit them. People in prison, go visit them. And he said, and when you have done it to them, you have done it unto me, right?
Exactly.
So that piece is very alarming, because when other institutions have failed, especially people of color, even when we talk about civil rights, guess what was the institution that fought for our issues? And it was the Black church. And Dr. King and others created the Black church as a hub to fight for justice and discriminatory issues that we experience, and racism and experience in our country. So when the Black church is not welcoming to another Black member of the community, yeah, that's a letdown. Then let's talk about grief. Yeah, then we talk about grief. Grief, you know, have five different stages. From, you know, you go through depression, then you shift from being pissed off and angry, right? And then you go on to try to be accepting about it. So you go through these different phases when we talk about grief. Grief is when anytime there's a major loss or there's a major change in our life, it opens the door for grief. And usually death is both. It's certainly a major change, because now that family member is not part of the family, they're dead and gone. And then two, it just from a mental and emotional, it just devastates you. Sometimes it's hard with grief, because some people don't know how to support people in grief. You get some people that talk too much, think they have all the answers. And sometimes you're just like, man, will you just shut up? Number two, I get tired of 1,000 people asking me, how you doing? What do you think I'm feeling right now? Are you kidding me, right? So I think even sometimes when we talk about grief, that members of our family, members of our community can really get on our last nerves because they're not sensitive to what we're going through. Sometimes you just need a person just to be a space, right? Like, I don't need you to say a whole lot. I just need you to be available. And that's very, very important when it comes to grieving. Next thing I would say, it is important to grieve. We have a lot of people that go through their circumstances and they refuse to grieve. And so that goes back to that bleeding on people that didn't cut us, is that when we don't allow ourselves to grieve, it's detrimental to our wellness, it's detrimental to our health, our mental, emotional, and our physical. You lose weight, you're not eating, you're stressed out. Depending on your stress, if you start getting into your 40s and your 50s, stress can turn into shingles. So we also got outbreaks that really can be painful, that I know people that have at a certain age, because of their stress level, it really debilitates their health and wellness. So, so grief is something that is necessary, that when you have a major change, it is healthy to grieve. Now, nobody can tell somebody how long they should grieve. I think that is a big issue, right? Is they're like, well, it's been 6 months. Like, why is you still looking like that? I mean, people can really say some insensitive things. And grief just looks different from every person. It may take one person, they may be able to get through it in 8 months. It may take 2 years for others. It may take five. but allow people to grieve so that they can become the best version of themselves and they can start connecting with new relationships. It's hard to do that when you're still in that deep dive of a grieving season, and it's okay. And again, I always say, I like to affirm people who are hurting and say, it's okay to be not to be okay. It's okay to say, you know what? I, if you're really my friend, I don't need you judging me. And I just need you to just ride this out with me for these next couple weeks because I'm just triggered. Another thing I want to say about grief is the anniversary of a case or the anniversary of death, right? A lot of times we don't talk enough about when that anniversary date is coming, how it is start pulling on your soul and pull on your spirit. So you really also need good friends, families, and doctors putting a wrap around service of support when that anniversary start coming, because you start feeling triggered. You start feeling those emotions again. So I go all kind of way. I don't take too much time, but I just want to make sure I'm addressing a lot of issues.
I really appreciate you bringing up that last point there, especially since my son's been missing since June 11, 2003. So like every year people would look forward to me doing something. I'm tired of letting loose balloons and killing the animals. Yeah. I'm just saying, yeah. I'm a human. Yeah. I like saving the environment. I'm not saying anything bad about people who want to do that, because if that's what you have to do, do what you have to do. But I personally, I would prefer the flowers maybe, because they'll go back to nature, you know. But so I just think like that. But I appreciate the sentiment. I appreciate those people who are remembering my child and want me to do those things, because just the idea that they want to do that is enough for me. You know, I'm like one of those people, the intrinsic things, and it doesn't have to be extrinsic, you know, with me. It's, if I know that you love me, that means more to me than anything. You know, just that you call me to say I'm thinking about you, that's everything to me. But a lot of times I think people find themselves feeling like they have to go to that same location, and they have, like, at one point I feel like I did, to show the world I'm not done with this, and I'm going to get justice. And I did, but everybody's not able to do that. So I don't want people with missing loved ones or murdered loved ones to feel like they always have to go out and tie a teddy bear around a tree. If you don't feel like doing that, don't do it. You know, because sometimes that's opening. You can't heal and go forward because you still have to wrap this teddy bear around a tree. Okay. And then every day you pass in that same tree in the rain, snow, sleet, and I'm just saying, I've seen, there was this one poster that was in St. John. And every time I went down by the highway, I would see it. I saw it fade away. Where you couldn't even really see the ink on the flower anymore. And I always look, I still look even though it's not there, because it's a memory. But I just want people to understand that we are in charge of our thoughts. You know, as a man thinketh, you know, I have to remember, like Yolanda Adams put that on sometimes, or just say it in my head, that be anxious for nothing, but in all things through prayer and petition. I still have to do certain things just to get my mind right. That's why I say I have to eat right. I have to sleep right. I have to think right. I have to exercise. I have to do those things that I just know I need to do. Take my vitamins to make sure I'm regulated, you know, and, you know, stay away from certain crowds, stay away from certain subjects. At one point in time when this was new, I couldn't watch action movies because I was ready to go and do some action. You know, and that's just the real. I did a prison ministry with another organization years ago to help them to understand that could have been me where you are. You know, because I, like I said, I'm a thinker, so I could think about what I could do. And if I would have got caught in doing what I thought about doing, I would have been them. So it's only by the grace of God that some of us are not where we could be.
Well, you know what?
So it's all about choices. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. No, I mean, I love listening to everything you have to say. I just want to ask Dr. Hull, because I know you're a pastor as well, in combination with like being a doctor and everything like that.
Yeah.
So what do you say to people when they ask you, how do I grieve? Because I think people don't understand, how does that happen? How does it work? What do you do? How do you resolve? How do you know you're grieving? You know what I'm saying? Like, truly. You know, like in my instance, my brother's been gone. We lost him to melanoma, you know, back in 2012. You know, he was 34, about to get married, his whole life ahead of him. And his cancer took him out just like that, right? So for us, it was very shocking education about melanoma. Aside from that, but also just the grieving process. It was so, because we were so close, you know, you expect the older people to go before you, right? So that's kind of something you're kind of ready for. You've seen it and all that. But when it's a sibling and it's someone close to you, or like Thea, like her son, all that, it's just like, how do you know that process? You know what I'm saying? And how do you know when you're done? Or are you ever done?
Well, in levels of grief, I just think that there's different stages. I will say that no matter how long time goes, you're never fully going to just not feel. That's not what grieving is. And I think that some people think that, well, I'm a grieve, it's going to be over. No, that's not even being realistic. You're going to always, that birthday, that whatever you did as a ritual for Christmas, what did you guys do for Thanksgiving and 4th of July? Those things will bring a level of emotions. And so one of the things in cognitive therapy is always, we always say that what feeds your mood is what you've been thinking about for a good size amount of time. If you keep thinking about a certain thing, it impacts your mood for the positive or the negative. And so another thing I want to throw out is, when we talk about grieving, how do I know? I know how a person's grieving by looking at what they're not doing. When they go into a cave and they shut everybody out, or when they are showing a lot of avoidance, and not wanting to feel powerless, they go into this cave and they put themselves in this cocoon, which opens the door for depression. Because believe it or not, everybody needs somebody. Every single person. If Jesus needed 12, trust me, everybody needs somebody. And you have to allow yourself to feel, and that hurts. It hurts like hell, right? But you can't avoid it. And so what people do is they dissociate and they detach. And what happens is, when they dissociate and detach, they put themselves on this island all by themselves, and they don't face their feelings and their emotions. And it's tough. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. It is not easy to deal with those kind of emotions. And it is easier sometimes to show avoidance. But you've got to drive through it. You have to embrace it. You have to allow yourself to feel. Now, this is where I said we don't talk about trauma resilience enough. Is that there is strength in the midst of pain. There is perseverance in the midst of trials. And that's where we can also, if negative images in my mind can get me depressed, certainly positive experiences with my loved one that's no longer with me can ignite a level of joy as well. And so, as you just quoted, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. I am the product of my thoughts. So if I start using more positive experiences that I've had with my child, or I have with my brother, that puts smiles on my face, that puts you in a brighter and a better mood. And then again, grief looks different from every person. Some people need 12 months. Somebody else need 48. But whatever that is, it's okay to be okay. And then loved ones, the church folk talks about, they want to quote scripture, be deep. You know, I don't need that right now. Just let me cry. You know what I'm saying? Just let me cry. Let me, Jesus cry, man. Come on. So Jesus showed emotion. So if the Son of God could do it, then certainly who am I? So I just think we need to just be realistic. Don't set high expectations. That's not realistic, because that, if anything to make you depressed, is setting goals too high that you can't attain. Just go through. And then it's day by day, as a journey. And there's all kinds of things you can do. You can see a therapist. You can see a doctor. You might need prescription. I'm not a big fan of just throwing. I don't like doctors just throwing prescription on everybody. But if you get so psychotic, if your depression shifts from mild, from moderate to manic, what we might need is to actually put you on prescription to get you regulated, so that somebody can talk to you, right? If you're out of it, you can get so manic that no matter what anybody say, it's non-effective. So sometimes we might have to put you on some type of antidepressant, any anxiety, some type of psychotropic type of medicine to get you into a space of calm so that now the practitioner, the doctor, the pastor, whoever that is, can now speak into your space. But if your frontal lobe is hijacked, if you, yeah, so all of that stuff matters when we start talking about that healing journey. Yes, you do need to eat better. You do need to go to the gym and work your body out. All of that plays a part on your moods as well. You do need to watch your diet. There's some restrictions on your nutrition that certain people with psychotic issues should not even be putting in their body. I'll tell you that right now. And when they do, and on top of that, they're low on vitamin D3. Most Arizonians here, because it's so hot with the sun, we don't even get enough of our vitamin D. So we see that in the science that low vitamin D means dysregulation in moods, right? Impact your serotonin levels. Your diet, if we eating all this red dye, all this sugar, all of these processed foods, and all these omega-6 and not enough omega-3s, we see it in the science. You're going to have more dysregulation, vitamin D deficiencies. So yeah, so many different spaces too. And we're talking about social, emotional. It's not just about therapy sitting in somebody's chair. Yes. From a doctor's perspective, I'm looking at the whole picture, looking at your diet, looking at your microbiome. A lot of people don't know in your microbiome, which is your digestive tract. If you got imbalances with a lot of bad bacteria versus good bacteria, that flora that should be more positive, that impacts your serotonin levels too. So it's way bigger than just sitting in somebody's chair talking about depression. If you come to Dr. Ho, I'm doing your labs. I'm going to look at your panels. I'm going to be looking at everything and say, all these dots got to click for you to really be regulated mentally and emotionally.
So this is what I call holistic education right here. The whole thing. Can I just fly in to see you?
Dr. Hunt, I think she's just trying to get an appointment to see what's going on.
And I want the book too.
So we'll talk about the books in just a second. I just want to ask something really quickly. We have about 7 minutes left. Just really quickly, Dr. Ho, and maybe Theta, you can chime in on this as well. The impact of COVID, I'm kind of switching up a little bit, but the impact on COVID on our society and what's happened, what have you seen, Dr. Holt, with that as far as a change in how things are with people, with all the loss and the mental health, and there's so many things that have happened. What have you seen? What did you see? And what are you seeing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that we've seen a lot. We've seen mental health skyrocket 3 times higher than ever. So a lot of doctors were worn out, ER doctors, a lot of colleagues, clinicians. One of the things we saw is the doctors that you went to help you, we were burned out. The numbers of patients and clients had skyrocketed. We just couldn't take no more. I remember my wife, I travel. So I travel to school districts all over the nation supporting them. And my wife's like, no, you need to sit still for a minute. Like, you got to be your own self-care. You got to do what you're teaching the whole nation to do and what you're writing books about to do. And that was extremely wise to have a partner, a wife to really, call me on the carpet and like, no, you're not Jesus, right? So you're going to have to do your own. So COVID skyrocketed also substance abuse. So we start seeing alcohol. We start seeing people doing meth. We start seeing opioids, fentanyl, still, which is an issue today, start increasing as well because people just didn't know how to deal with the massive amount of grief. Pastors were suffering from extreme depression because they were burying their members left and right, and there was nothing they could do. Pastors also struggled too because of the fact that not only did they die, but the hospital prevented them from visiting. So they were dying, and they couldn't even get to the hospital to even support them and pray for them. And so it was just so much going on when the school systems had closed. And so kids began to dissociate in social distancing. So they wasn't learning. And then when we brought them back mentally, emotionally, I did a survey on students, and a lot of them said they wasn't even prepared to even be back mentally, emotionally. And then they lost certain classmates and family members. So they were going through stuff. So yeah, we start talking about what did COVID do to us? It really traumatized the nation. And you still got to remember, you know, not picking sides, not being political, but we had Trump in office that was doggone not really doing nothing about it. And that was traumatizing people. I mean, having questionable practitioners speaking into this space and not listening to, man, what was that guy named? Dr. Fauci.
Fauci. Dr. Like well, Fauci.
Yeah. Yeah. So wasn't even listening to Dr. Fauci. I mean, put him on the sideline, took him off the air to give us some of the best practices on how to deal with COVID. I mean, so when you start talking about that stuff, it's so big. And now that I'm not going to say COVID is over because we still can catch COVID, just got different strands now. But pretty much the post-COVID era has drastically been impacted from education. Mm-hmm. Academics is ridiculous right now. Kids' behavior is off the chain. They're dysregulated. We got teachers that lost people. So they're trying to get into a classroom space to offer instruction, and they are emotionally imploding. Teachers' burnout now is in October of the school season, and that's not even second semester. I mean, so wherever you want to go with this, Chandra, I can tell you COVID has really impacted the country.
All right. So it looks like we've got about 2 minutes left. So I just want to make sure I get the details about like the books and all that stuff, what you guys are doing, so we can wrap that up really quickly. Yeah. Dr. Holt, tell me about the books and where can people find you, Dr. Holt?
All right. So number one, the book that's really, you know, selling right now is Trauma, the New Public Health Emergency in Education. If you're an educator, social worker, counselor, principal, school superintendent, you most definitely want that book. You want this book going forth. And then two, I got about 10, so I'm only gonna do two. So
okay.
Hurting people hurt people. Stop Bleeding on People is another book on Amazon that you most definitely want to get. And I'll say thirdly, I just published my doctoral dissertation. The name of it is called My Body's on Fire, Inflammation, the Silent Killer. If you want to really learn where a lot of the root causes of why Americans are not getting better is because of chronic and cellular inflammation. So go get those books, read them, spread the word of healing. And I just want you to know, no matter what has happened to you in your past, trauma may be your history, but it does not have to rob you of your destiny. So let's go. Let's help people.
Right on. 1 minute, Theta. All right, before I wrap this, I got 1 minute.
Okay. Well, I've been throwing myself more so into the arts, and like I said, kind of transitioning into more of that impact politically in the community, or more of an impact. But my art name is Theta Rocks. Theta Roxanne is my birth name, Theta Roxanne Wilson. So if you look up Theta Rocks, that's me.
Thank you both. Conversation was phenomenal, and I'll be putting the podcast out. I'll be putting adding information like toward, you know, the beginning and ends of it, so people can catch on all the stuff that you guys were talking about. But again, Dr. Holt, thank you so much, Dr. Damond Holt, Theta Person, Theta Wilson. I'm not know which name I'm going to go with. I'm just going to leave it there.
It's going to be Theta Wilson for life.
Okay, got you. When it comes to my final thoughts about this episode, I can say it's one of the deepest conversations that I've had on my podcast. Through all of my years of doing this podcast on missing persons and murder cases, I always knew there was a lot of trauma mixed in and involved with it, and now I have more insight into how people can handle that. And I hope you learned something along the way. As for future endeavors, it looks like Dr. Holt will continue his work to serve his church and his community. And remember, he said he had like 10 books out there, and he only mentioned a couple, but you can find them all on Amazon. You can just search his name. And another thing is, I will add that link to the description box in this episode. As for Theta, I know she's also working on moving forward in her work as an advocate by fighting for funding and legislation that can help people with missing loved ones. And I know for sure that she won't stop.
This was a fulfilling and thoughtful conversation, and I'm looking forward to sharing this with as many people as possible. If you have a story or an issue that you want me to check out, just go to my Intrigued Full Effect website or my Facebook page and message me there, or send me an email at intriguedfulleffect@hotmail.com. Until next time, be safe and stay true. The views, information, or opinions expressed during the Intrigued Full Effect, Curious Cases, Disappearances, and Other Stuff podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of the host. The primary purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. The host of this podcast assumes no liability or responsibility for any activities in connection with opinions shared in the podcast. The podcast and blog associated with it shall not be used in any legal capacity or as a basis for expert testimony. Any copyright material in the podcast is approved by the owner or is part of the public domain. Music by Pond 5.